Welcome to Words First, talking text in opera. The New York Times says, if the music of Ricky Ian Gordon had to be defined by a single quality, it would be the bursting effervescence of infusing songs that blithely blur the lines between art song and the high-end Broadway music of Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim. It's caviar for a world gorging on pizza. Indeed, Ricky Ian Gordon is a composer who crosses fluidly from opera to musicals to song cycles to instrumental pieces, collaborating with many librettists and lyricists across genre. In fact, he's collaborated with a number of people who have been interviewed on this podcast, and I heard his name over and over last season as I put together my episodes. For instance, here's Broadway lyricist Michael Corey talking about his long-term friendship with Ricky and how he was convinced to take on Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath.
Well, Ricky and I went a way back. We actually lived one block apart. Since we lived so close to each other, we said, you know, this would be easy to collaborate. We could wake up, have our coffee, and do some work and write an opera. But we never found the right project. Mm-hmm. We used to meet at the corner bodega buying milk. Mm. One day at the corner bodega, he said, I had an idea. These people came to me and said, do you want to write The Grapes of Wrath? And I said, keep thinking. That's insane. He says, no, reread it. Have you read it? Yeah, I read it in high school. Well, reread it again. And I said, that's insane. You know, to try and do a 400-page book in an opera, when opera attenuates everything.
Yeah.
Then I read it. And I realized that Steinbeck wrote it in three acts.
And here's librettist and director Leonard Folia speaking to me about being a relatively new librettist while working with Ricky on A Coffin in Egypt at Houston Grand Opera and the wise words he took to heart during the process.
Ricky Ian Gordon has a great phrase, you know, when he told me I write too many words, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he always would say, Lanny, I can't do his voice. He's got a great voice.
He'd
just say, boil it down to stock.
Nice. I like that. I'm stealing that.
Stock. Boil it down to stock.
That's excellent.
And, you know, sometimes you need to, you know, you write it all out and then you go, oh, how can I say this? There are eight words in this phrase. How can I make it three?
Right.
And that becomes a wonderful challenge. And it's always better.
He is well-loved by those with whom he collaborates, both as writing partners and as creators of roles, as we hear in this clip of mezzo-soprano Friederike von Stade also talking about A Coffin in Egypt and its resonance for her.
In Coffin in Egypt, that taught me so much about myself now, because I'm her age, and I know I was very close to both my grandmothers, who were exactly her vintage. So I knew them extremely well. And they were both a powerful women, type of women that I don't think you see so much today, women my age, you know, who their lives in many instances were determined by very, very strong objects that they had to deal with in their lives. That even my grandmother von Stade, who came, was very, very privileged and very spoiled in her life, had to deal with terrific amounts of courage. And I know what those women like. So it was, I just loved doing that because I just thought of them the whole time we were in it, you know, about how courageous she was in many regards, you know. And so approaching that time of life I see what it's like. You know, it's very different. It's very different. What happens to you is that thing that they say of invisibility. You know, you become an invisible generation to many people because you're not the life force that they're all dealing with. And you have the consequences just of aging that, you know, take toll on your mind and your body and everything else. And the scripts, the words, the librettos, whatever, were so powerful and so beautifully written. I mean, really, I'm so enormously grateful for that part of it. And to be able to walk on a stage and basically be yourself with all its flaws is, you know, is a terrific gift.
I loved the stories I heard about Ricky, from Michael, Leonard and Flicka, Royce Vavreck, Mark Campbell, and many others. I was keen to get him on my Zoom screen and talk to him about the other side of the writing coin. What is it like to collaborate with librettists? What is it like to have relationships with so many writers, and how does your work change because of it? As I was preparing for that part of the conversation, I also remembered that he himself was a writer of words. In fact, I had directed his chamber opera, Orpheus and Eurydice, a few years ago, and marveled at the simplicity and depth of his words. When I started reading more about him, I realized that he had written his own libretti a number of times, and when I started talking to him, well, take a listen for yourself. Here's composer and librettist Ricky Ian Gordon from our interview on January 6th, 2021. Ricky, thank you so much for talking with me. I am so glad you're here.
Me too.
You know, last season I interviewed Royce Vavreck, Leonard Fulya, Michael Corey, and Mark Campbell, and your name kept coming up because you've collaborated with all of them. And
yes.
I do want to talk about collaboration and how you work with librettists, because I find the collaborative process in art making so interesting. But I actually want to start by pointing out that you've written the libretti and lyrics for several of your own works, and specifically the musicals Sycamore Trees and My Life with Albertine, and the chamber works Orpheus and Eurydice and Green Sneakers. And I know there were a few others, but those are the four that I was reading about. Can you tell me what drives you to write your own libretto or lyrics, and do you like working as a self-collaborator?
What drives me to write them, especially in three of those instances, in Green Sneakers, Orpheus and Eurydice, and in Sycamore Trees, they are autobiographical, right? So I had a need in all of those pieces to tell my own story. And because I've been obsessed with words my whole life, you know, my sisters read me poetry to put me to sleep when I was little. So I have always dabbled in writing. I've always written poems. And when it finally came time to write my own libretti, it was just the necessity of saying something I needed to say that I couldn't describe to someone else and have them say it. And the truth is, Katora, I really like it. When I'm setting my own words, I feel an enormous pressure. Like, I remember, for example, with Green Sneakers, I was away at UCross, you know, that arts colony in Wyoming. And I felt incredible pressure, like I could barely sleep, because I knew the poem was really sort of the text was really torn from some deep place inside of me right after Jeffrey died, and it was years later, and I knew that to balance the score with the words and not tip over into mawkish, or it was just that really I was scared about it,
right.
And I worked really hard, but it's very satisfying when it's done. It feels really personal. Orpheus, see, those pieces feel really personal to me. And you remember it, because even when you were going to direct Orpheus in Eurydice, we had very intimate conversations I felt like you were taking a little piece of me. And I knew it was going to be a piece of you.
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing. There's where the next collaboration comes in. And do you always feel like that when somebody's doing one of your autobiographical pieces, that you're entrusting them with a part of yourself?
Yes. I mean, I will say I feel like that with everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, every note feels autobiographical.
Sure.
But when it's my text,
yeah,
I feel a special responsibility. I really want people to at least understand my intentions before they discard them.
Yeah.
And by the way, and with My Life with Albertine, was the situation with that was Richard Nelson wanted to collaborate with me on this, you know, on this Proust adaptation. And he just knew my work and just ceded the responsibility. He was like, let's write these lyrics together. And we just wrote another one. We just wrote a musical theater piece based on Ingmar Bergman wrote a novel about his parents called Private Confessions, which actually Liv Ullmann directed a movie based on that novel, a beautiful movie. And Richard and I just wrote a new piece based on it.
Has it premiered or does it have a premiere date?
No, it hasn't premiered yet. And, you know, at this point, who knows when anything's going to premiere?
Oh, my goodness. You know? Isn't that the truth? Even the things that we think we know, they just tend to float away from us. In this.
Yeah, I mean, Lincoln Center, Intimate Apparel is supposed to happen next.
That's right.
All, you know, Garden of the Finzi Catinis is supposed to happen next winter.
Yeah.
We'll see, because things are, I don't know, it's just, all right, words and music.
I know, but I know it's hard in these times. And I, geez, so many, every interview I've done, I find it's so hard not to digress into it because it's just, it's taken
it's
over
what's happening.
Our life. It's everything. Yes. Yeah. And it's the reason we're all trying to figure out how to remain creatively lucid to borrow a word because here we are.
you know and it's interesting, Katora, when I came up here, so this is directly related to words. So I came up here March 12th. We were deep into rehearsals for Intimate Apparel. We were going to be opening March 23rd, you know, and that was at Lincoln Center, Borchere directing. It was going great. So I decided when I got up here, I had to just turn myself in a different direction. I just couldn't think about notes for a while. I mean, I actually did for a while. I did my rewrite for Intimate Apparel. Mm-hmm. I did, the orchestration for Finzi Continues is done. But then I started a writing group with a bunch of poets and novelists.
Oh,
I know.
Cool.
And it's once a week and I'm working primarily on prose and poetry. And it's been incredible, really incredible, like to just focus on words for a little while.
Do you feel like when you're writing words that it just, it's like it wakes up another part of your brain?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do. Mm-hmm. And I wrote some poems and then I wrote a lyric about the country. I literally wrote something called Oh America. I wrote, you know, Blythe Gessert
and her
husband, Lewis.
Yeah.
So Blythe is making this new CD and the theme is home. Mm-hmm. And she asked me to write something for it. And I thought about it for a while. And I ended up writing a piece about how when I was little, there was one boy in the town I grew up in, Island Park, and his name was Jerry Hammer. He was the only black kid. Mm. They were the only black family in Island Park. And he disappeared. Like, nobody really talked to him. One day he disappeared. Supposedly he was walking over Long Beach Bridge from Island Park, and it was the winter, and he fell off the bridge onto the ice and died.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
That way, and I have, for my whole life, I've been thinking about it, and I finally wrote Blythe a song called Jerry Hammer.
Oh, my.
And it was, the theme was home, because in the end, I sort of apologized and said, I wish I was your friend. I would have taken you home for dinner, you know, just whatever. But it has. I have been on another part of my brain. And sometimes I feel guilty, like, am I betraying music? But then I just got asked to do some concerts, and I'm still writing music, just not as I'm on words.
Yeah, I think that's okay. I think, you know, you're creativity is fed no matter what side of your brain or part of your brain you're using, and the music will come back. I think it's perfectly okay to take a pause. So
I think so. Yeah.
I wonder.
And I will have some texts to set to music.
Absolutely, and that's another huge part. Yeah. I want to go back to Orpheus and Eurydice and Green Sneakers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they're
absolutely
such, and as you mentioned earlier, they're such personal pieces. They come from, they're both specifically dealing with the death of your partner, I believe. And I just want to talk about each piece for a second. Orpheus and Eurydice, I know a fair amount about this piece because as we talked about, I directed it a few years ago in Vermont. And one of the things I remember you saying about it is that you wrote it in this sort of fever dream in the middle of the night. I read in an interview that while you were working on Ellen West, which is based on a poem by Frank Bedard, that you said, and I'm going to quote you here, you said, "I was so swept up, I would awaken at 4 a.m. while I was at HGO with Royce Vavrick working on our opera, The House Without a Christmas Tree, and those wee quiet hours when the world was silent and asleep were when the piece came into being." Do you find that your personal work comes to you with that? Is there something about that time of night, or do you find that you write words in that type of experience often, or are those two singular moments?
No, it's often. It seems to be that particular extreme hour when the rest of the world is asleep and there's true quiet in the world. You know, it's funny because 4 a.m. is l'heure bleue, right?
Right.
It's the moment when all the night creatures have gone to bed and none of the morning creatures have woken up. So it's quiet, really quiet. And especially up here, usually the moon, if there's a moon, it's right out my window up there. Wow. But it is somehow a moment when I feel like I'm in touch with the world behind the world. Uh-huh. I feel like I'm getting help from the spirit world at that. And I also feel like I trust the atmosphere of what enters the piece at those hours feels very authentic to me because I feel pretty unbridled and also unencumbered. So I, you know, Ellen West, the piece has a really, I think, sort of a wild nocturnal feeling to it. And it's because it was written at that time. And I think that the text to Orpheus and Eurydice, because it just exploded out at that time of morning. And I mean, you know, Jeffrey was in the room asleep and at a certain point he came out and I was just like sweating at the table. You're in another world, right. You know, and it feels like a superhuman feat, only not when it's happening. But then you look at all these pages and go, wow, what the fuck? So a really, and you know, when I was growing up, of course, I loved Ariel, Sylvia Plath's last book of poems.
Uh-huh.
And she wrote those poems when her children were asleep. And so that there is that 4 a.m. atmosphere about those poems that is
something about the veil being thinner. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so private. It's such a private time.
Yeah.
And there is an intimacy that you have with yourself and with your muse and with the spirit world and with, you know, and I'm a big sort of meditator. I try to keep a pretty good and good contact with my inner life because I get it. It's where everything comes from.
Uh-huh.
So, 4 a.m. And they couldn't be, the pieces were so antithetical. House Without a Christmas Tree and Ellen West.
Did you, when you wrote Orpheus and Eurydice, it being such a sort of explosion out of you, did you ever think it would become what it became? And by that, I think I mean both sort of content, both musically what it is, and also popularity. I mean, it's gone through these sort of bursts of people doing it. And I'm just curious what your thoughts of it did you think it would become something when you wrote it, or did it just sort of come out because it had to?
I didn't. It's funny. I want to just tell you something that came to mind when you said that. I have this woman I know. Her name is Hanya Yanagihara. And Kevin, my partner, used to work with her at Condé Nast Traveler. Uh-huh. But now she's the editor-in-chief at T Magazine at the New York Times. But she wrote a novel called A Little Life.
Uh-huh.
And this book was a sensation. I mean, it's like an 800-page novel. It's really hair-raising book about cutting. And I listened to an interview with her. She thought, like, you know, 5,000 copies at the most would sell. Mm-hmm. It was up for every award in the world. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
When that happened with Orpheus and Eurydice, all that I felt really when it was over was, oh my God, I did it, because it was such a difficult, painful, laborious process of meeting with Todd Palmer, who I wrote the piece for, over right. and over again, and having nothing. You know, and I just felt guilty and ashamed and useless and lame. And I had just met with him and said, just forget, I'll just write you a piece for clarinet and piano. Right. You know what I mean? I just said, like, and then I wake up and there's this dream, and Todd's in the dream, and he's wearing this, you know, striped a posh dancer t-shirt, like those French
mm-hmm.
striped t-shirts. And he's Orpheus. It's like I see the piece. I uh-huh. see the piece. And I just go in and literally, like, just pull out a piece of paper and write, Orpheus played his pipe, music like a cool blue stripe circling the heavens. And it just flies out of my pen. And so a lot of times, you know, I hate to admit this, but there's a lot of dread and relief in creating.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
You dread doing it. Then you do it. Then you're so relieved you did it. And it has a lot to do with why I'm a fan of my own work. Like, I'm not someone who hates my work once I've done it. I love it. I think it's beautiful. And I think a lot of it is because it's so excruciating. Everything leading up to it, the writing of it, then it's there. And you're like, wow. All that, and here it is. I mean, I had this experience a couple of years ago. Eastman School of Music did my opera, The Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Uh-huh.
Tibetan Book of the Dead was literally an opera I wrote to help Jeffrey die.
I was going to say, this is also a very personal sort of
oh my God.
Piece that surrounds that time of your life.
It changed everything, that piece. Uh-huh. And that's when everything changed, because it was like writing a piece in an emergency room for an emergency room.
Wow.
It was like the opera for the intensive care unit. And so I hadn't really looked about or thought about that piece for a long time, and I was really scared
mm-hmm.
going up there. I just thought, what is this going to be like? I was sort of excited they were doing it and thought, I don't even know. What is it even like? What is it? It was ravishingly beautiful to me. It
wow.
was so moving. The guy, Stephen Daigle, came up with a stunning concept,
uh-huh.
really moving. And I watched that opera and I was like, holy shit. Like, I didn't even remember writing it, because, you know, it was every day was a full on death and life emergency at that time in my life.
Of course.
I mean, the day could start okay, and 2 hours later, Jeffrey would have pneumocystis pneumonia, and we'd go through an almost dying, and then 2 hours later, he'd be fine again.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that is all to say, you know, in to be circular, there is, you know, that thing that Stravinsky says, I am the vessel through which passed La Sacra.
Uh-huh.
There is something that comes through you when you create. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that you don't need all the things you have, all the tools you have to get it down on paper. There is something else that ignites the fire inside of you for a piece. It always happens And it's different every time, but it always happens. And it's always the nerve-wracking thing before you write a piece is, will it happen this time? Right. And it's funny because people say, like, when you're about to write an opera, like Orpheus and Eurydice, Green Sneakers, do you hear it in your head beforehand? And what I always say is, you don't hear the notes, but you feel like a shadow pressing up behind you. And the shadow feels like the whole piece. It feels like the atmosphere of the piece, the sort of sound world of the piece. You don't hear the motifs, but you have a sense of what the vibe of the piece is going to be.
Do you feel that way when you write words too, or is it just music?
No, words too. And that's why, you know, I really admire these people, you know, like Michael and Mark and Royce, who write words every day. For me, they come less frequently and with more difficulty than music. I could write music every day, but a text explodes, or it's the necessity has to rise in me. I mean, this thing I wrote recently, Oh America, I was in excruciating psychic pain about what was happening in this country.
Oh, man.
It just seemed unbearable to me.
Yeah,
and it's funny. I just picked it up and rewrote it because I realized I had to add a coda of hope.
Right, because we are all in a coda of hope right now.
Yeah, there's a possible respite. You know, I don't know if I'm answering your question.
You are. No, it's conversation. You know, I love the conversation. I do want to go back for a second to Green Sneakers, just to sort of complete the. I feel like Orpheus and Eurydice and Green Sneakers are of a piece. They're a duo.
They're a side A and side B.
Right, and
that's
Green Sneakers came 7 years later or thereabouts, and it was a commission. Was it something that you had already started thinking about before it was commissioned, or was this something that came directly out of the commission process?
No, well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. We had just premiered The Grapes of Wrath in Minnesota, right? February 10th, 2007, we premiered Grapes of Wrath.
Yep.
And the next city it was going to was Utah, Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
And right before I went to Salt Lake City, Jeannie Zuckerman, who was running the Bravo Vail Valley Music Festival in Vail, asked me if I would be the artist in residence for the summer. For the summer of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, we have a string quartet in residence, the Miami String Quartet. She was like, we'd love it if you could write like a 10-minute string quartet, which is sort of the story of my life, 10-minute. Like Todd wanted, you know, a little follow-up to Shepherd on the Rock, and I wrote Orpheus and Eurydice, which is why I didn't think it would go anywhere, because it's like a 70-minute piece for, you know, a clarinetist. So, but then, so I was like, okay, I'll do that. And so when we got to Utah, at that moment, I meditate every day, but I was in a place in my life then where I was meditating an hour every morning.
Oh, wow.
Which is a lot. That's a big meditation. So one morning I'm meditating and it's one of those things. I see Green Sneakers. I had written those poems, you know, right after Jeffrey died, staring at his sneakers.
Yeah, so this is what I was going to ask you. So those words actually really came first and came pre-commission. So this was something you had in your coffer before.
And as soon as I saw it in my head, I thought, uh-oh, that's what I'm writing.
Yeah.
That's what am I going to do? That's not going to be 10-minute string quartet. And I actually called Jake Heggie. Because Jake knew Jeannie. And we had both worked with Jeannie. We did concerts with her together. And I said, let me read you the text. And I read him the text of Green Sneakers, and Jake said, just write it. Don't even tell her. Just write it. She'll say yes, but get it done first.
Right.
So I did that. I wrote the piece, and I did two things. I also called Jesse Blumberg, because Jesse was in The Grapes of Wrath. there was about something about Jesse. He had such a naturalness and honesty on the stage. He was the least opera-ish performer I think I've ever seen right from the get-go. He did nothing operatic. Do you know what I mean, Katora? Like, he was one of those people who lives in his body. He walks onto the stage. He's a whole person singing with his voice. And the whole thing. Now, that was a cast full of brilliant actor-singers.
Yes,
I mean,
Deanne
Meek, get out of here. Get out. They're all geniuses. But this, I could imagine, and maybe even I knew that Jesse's Jewish or half Jew. I could imagine him being me. And so I had to call him and say, I'm going to send you this text. And I want you to tell me if you could imagine delivering this piece, because that is one intense, personal, intimate piece. And I even knew that, you know, Jesse's heterosexual, and that piece is bathed in love, one man's love for another. And he said, I'd be honored. So I wrote the piece. And so then I was in New York and I called Jeannie and I said, I said, okay, Jeannie, I have to talk to you about something. I wrote the piece. It's not 10 minutes. It's an opera. And I don't need a concert hall. I need a theater. And but before you say no or yes, let me read you the poem. And I read her the poem and we cried together on the phone. And she said, absolutely. And it was Lynn Mazza and Jeannie Zuckerman. They ran the festival. They gave me everything I wanted. I had a director, this lovely guy, Jonathan Solari. Wendell Harrington gave me for free. She did a full set of projections, gorgeous, heartbreaking projections for nothing. We go, we have a theater, we do this. I mean, that was so intense, Katora. Like, the day before we opened, we had one dress rehearsal in this theater, and there was a critic. His name was Wes Blomster. I loved Wes Blomster. He loved me, and he loved Jake, too. He used to write for the Denver Post. And he came to the only, he was the only person who came to this dress rehearsal, and he sat in the sort of middle back, and we ran the piece. And when it was over, Wes Blomster was shaking and sobbing. It was really intense. And I've never had this experience with a critic. You know, as a matter of fact, sometimes they're shaking and sobbing because they hate me so much. But he's, so I go and I'm holding him. And the next day we open and just, you know, his review was like, Gordon creates masterpiece. He compares it to Das Lied von der Erde. And it was intense. The night we opened in that theater, okay, after the show, the whole audience assembled in the lobby, and we had this conversation. I had a conversation with the audience about loss and grief. I mean, that has never happened to me. Everyone in that lobby was crying, and each person would like wanted to share about their loss. Lynn Mazza came backstage when it was over and just collapsed in my arms. I don't want to be one of those people that's like, I remember one time on opening night of A Quiet Place in Washington, D.C., and we were at a party with Leonard Bernstein afterwards, with Lenny afterwards. And he was like, when did you start crying? And it rubbed me the wrong way. I'm like, I don't want to be told I should have cried or not cried.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be that person saying everybody cried. I am just sharing it to say, at least for that moment in time, whatever I meant to translate about that experience in my life seemed to have happened.
Yeah.
What that piece is and what it does in the world is no longer up to me. But for a moment in time, Green Sneakers was really the full-on representation of what that time was for me. And Orpheus was too. But in Orpheus, I told it through a metaphor, through a myth.
Right.
And that was the first way I could tell it. And if I hadn't written Orpheus and Eurydice, I couldn't have turned the record over and written the bald face absolute way it happened.
Yeah, I that's so funny. I was actually going to ask you about that, because the Green Sneakers, even in the writing of the words, came later than Orpheus. And I think it's so interesting how we set ourselves up as creative artists to be able to move forward. So it's like Orpheus set you up to be able to create Green Sneakers. I find that really fascinating and so true to the process that we all go through.
And it's what I feel like I'm doing now in my writers group. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm using it because I came to a place in my life where it is time for me to move past a lot of my issues. Mm-hmm. And so I'm writing things in that group. Sometimes I can't even believe they have to listen to what I'm about to do. I mean, I can't. Thank God. They are really, it's writers I really admire, and they're really good writers. And they treat me with respect, and they understand that I'm just exploding on the page. You know what I mean? But it's so good for me. It's been really good.
Can we talk about your musical writing for a bit? I'm thinking of the two that you wrote the lyrics for, Sycamore Trees and My Life with Albertine. What do you find different about writing a musical versus writing an opera or song cycle?
Okay, let's start talking about Sycamore Trees, okay?
Sure.
When you write a musical, you are sewing those songs together into a larger fabric. Mm-hmm. With something like Green Sneakers and Orpheus and Eurydice, you're telling the entire story mm-hmm. in the text you're going to be setting to music. Whereas in a musical, you have this book, or you have a sort of larger skeleton, and the songs are not the whole story. So you have to decide how they're going to function.
Right.
And where they're going to, some people say, oh, they have to take you from A to B, or they have to, everybody thinks they know what a song is supposed to do. But for every new musical that is suddenly a hit mm-hmm. or that's even created, songs have a new and special function. And the form of musicals is always changing, right? Mm-hmm. But so I would say in Sycamore Trees, in a way, I was sort of creating this musical vaudeville about a family. And I used the word vaudeville, but it was like I used the word vaudeville in the same way Stephen Sondheim used the word the Follies. Uh-huh. Follies.
Yeah.
It's a sort of tragic vaudeville, though there's vaudevillian aspects to it.
Uh-huh.
There are scenes, and there's text, and there's spoken word. So you have to be always thinking. And in Albertine, and this was something, Richard Nelson is a wonderful playwright. Mm-hmm. And he, both times we've written musicals together now, I really see something about him. And I know it is true of his work, The Dead, too, right? Where he musicalized the James Joyce, which is, he could never write a musical like, say, like Fiddler on the Roof. For him, the frame and the music, it has to make sense to him in a very particular theatrical way. So, for example, in My Life with Albertine, the frame is this man right at the top comes out and says, I'm going to tell you the story about my life with Albertine. And he's set up a little theater, a little salon in the home of a rich friend. Mm. And so right from the beginning, we are being told the story of my life with Albertine. So the songs always make sense in that there's nothing false about them. We always know the curtain is there and the stage is there, and this is an entertainment, which is very Brechtian, right?
I mean, yes.
Funny. I've been watching a lot of movies lately, and I've been watching a lot of Godard. So the other night I watched Vivre Sa Vie, and there's some moments in that movie. And the scene, that movie is done in many little scenes that are all named. There's a blackout and there's a title, and then the scene goes. Uh-huh. And at one point, Anna Karenina is saying a line, and she says it over and over again. And the man says something to her, and she goes, no, I'm just trying to figure out what's the best way to say that line. And that is a Brechtian device.
Totally.
That's epic theater. It suddenly takes you right out of the story and says, we're in a movie. And this is an actress. And this is a scene. And that's a line.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, the movie has an impact. And some of its impact is particularly because of that distance.
Mm.
And that's what Brecht was doing. That's what Godard is doing actually a lot. I mean, I think that's probably his whole thesis is based on Brecht.
You know, I've spoken to so many librettists over the last year, and I always ask them about collaboration. One of the things I'm always interested in is how they feel they are as a collaborator, and do they change their style or the way they work based on who they're collaborating with? So I want to ask you the same question. Do you feel you make different work or approach making work differently with different librettists?
Yes. Each of those librettists has entirely their own universe in their words, right?
Yeah.
Starting with Michael Corey, when I first started working with Michael Corey, I had never met anyone truly in my life. And by the way, this I'm talking about even Stephen Sondheim, mm-hmm. because I think what Michael Corey does is different.
Mm-hmm.
You could take a whole scene of a book or a whole scene of a play and find a way to musicalize it in such a tight, structured, brilliantly rhymed, like something that you look at on the page and know immediately what to do musically.
Mm.
Like when the first thing I saw of Michael's for Grapes of Wrath was when he took the entire first chapter of the Grapes of Wrath, which is just about the end of rain.
Mm-hmm.
Who would even think he would dramatize that? And he dramatizes it and calls it The Last Time There Was Rain. And it's nothing but, you know, croppers coming through the corn and telling you about the end of the rain and the beginning of the drought and the ruination of their land.
Wow.
And it's utterly tragic. And it's like, you know, just reading the lyric that Steinbeck would be proud.
Yeah.
Because he even finds a way to encompass Steinbeck's language, you know, in a book where people go, yep, nope, meh, meh, and Michael finds a way to find in the prose the most exquisite things for them to say while they never sound overly articulate.
Right.
It just was a dream. That was a dream come true, The Grapes of Wrath. It was hard because our first, you know, when you get to the opera company and you do your first read through on night number one.
Yes.
The opera was over 5 hours long. So I was like, oh dear. And I just was like, you know, like Casey sang his first aria and a half hour into it, I'm thinking, oh my, we just met him. Like, he's got to shut up. So I remember the next day, I've never felt so scared and freaked out about how much cutting I had to do. But it was also a great learning experience. And Michael and I both learned because, you know, we did a lot of overwriting, but I was very happy with what we pulled out of our overwriting. And that means all 37 versions of The Grapes of Wrath, which mm-hmm. we practically have now. One of the companies wanted a poet as a librettist. And I said, oh no, I love poets and I love poetry, but I need someone who writes for the theater.
Yeah.
This is a huge book and it has to be dramaturged.
Yes.
And Michael is also a brilliant dramaturg. I do have to say that. And so he saw inside the book, the three act structure. And it was, and he created this, I feel like he created something really theatrical. It's like, to me, Grapes of Wrath is like a big 3.5 hour musical.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Michael said the same thing. I love
that. Well, that's, yeah. Rail, he did?
Yeah.
That's what we did. It's like a big, fat, old ballad opera yeah. musical. And that's what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he listens to me. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a big duet at the end of Act One called One Store. When Michael first showed me that part of the libretto, it was just a scene. And it was just Connie singing about the Lincoln Zephyr. And I said, Michael, this is where this falls in Act One. This has to be the big love duet.
Right.
This has to set up the rest of the opera. all of Rosa Shorn's yearning has to be what this opera's about. Mm-hmm. So he comes back the next day with one star. It's dazzling with Mark Campbell. Mark and I have known each other since we got to New York together, which is like 400 years ago, okay? I've known him since I got to New York, literally. He used to write with this guy, Stephen Hoffman. We were all friends and we all knew each other. So I've known, I knew Mark when he wrote all of his musicals, like Splendora and all. By the time, you know, and I wanted to work with Mark, so I got him on board this project on Rappahannock County.
Yep.
And I already knew what Mark did. And what was so admirable about Mark was we had the Civil War to deal with.
Yeah, this little thing.
400 billion books. So we were reading all these books. And it was Mark who brilliantly narrowed it down to one county in Virginia and took historical characters from that and based it on each year of the Civil War. And he just created these tight, brilliant little vignettes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mark knows me so well. With Mark, it was so easy, and I just felt like he leaned into what I do.
Mm-hmm.
With Lenny brought me aboard of A Coffin in Egypt. He had already directed A Coffin in Egypt
as a play, yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. And he did it in that Sag Harbor in the Bay Street Theater,
yep,
which my friend Mary was the architect for, Mary O'Connor.
Oh, wow.
And he, And so he already knew that play backwards and forwards. And he and Patrick brought me on board partially because I think Flicka wanted me.
Yes.
Because she liked the way I wrote for The Voice. What was great about that was that Lenny, I feel like this was somewhat new for him, writing an opera. Yes,
absolutely. Well, and he'd worked with the mariachi form, but he hadn't really
But had he? That. I thought the mariachi came after.
It came before. So this Coffin in Egypt was the second piece the second libretto he'd written.
Okay, yeah. So listen, there were wonderful, and there were challenges with Coffin in Egypt and Lenny, only because Lenny was the first one who, and Lenny is, we are one talented guy, so this is, but he needed to understand a little better how much time music adds to words and to music.
Yeah, he told me, and it's one of the things that always I just think about, because he said he was struggling with a section of it, and he was talking to you about it, and you just looked at him and said, "Lenny, boil it down to stock."
and
he just really took that. He said that changed everything about the way he thought about writing that piece, which was really interesting to hear. You know, how sometimes it's just that one
thing. It was great. Thing. Yes, because he was spreading out all over the place. And he would hand me these lyrics. And I would be like, "Lenny, this is like going to be The Ring. Just this one lyric. You have to boil it down to a stock. What are you saying here?" And he was such a good sport, because he'd come over and he'd read me stuff. And when I say those things, by the way, they come from a couple of places, but the big place they come from usually is terror. Because if I look at too many words on a page, I know my job is not going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's not going to be, I'm not going to be thinking about being a composer. I'm just going to be thinking about getting all these words set to music.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like when a director has 400 people in a chorus that they have to move around. You stop thinking about directing and just think about where you're going to put all these people.
It's so hard. I mean, by the way, and that's why Eric Simonson had Doug Verone for Grapes of Wrath. But he was such a good sport about it, and I really love what we came up with. Oh, and then, you know, Lenny had used already existing gospel songs for when he did it, and I was like, I write my own gospel songs.
Yeah.
And I have to hand it to Lenny. He went off and wrote those beautiful
You know, and I love the whole thing, but those gospel songs, the alchemy of the two of you with his lyrics and your music of those gospel songs is just so brilliant and beautiful and heartbreaking. They're wonderful.
I love them. And I feel like, I really do feel like that's where I loved pushing him.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I know he felt when we first started this that we were going to use existing gospel songs.
Right, because he's from the theater, so he doesn't think about it.
And you know how I got them, Couture? Mm-hmm. I had to tell Patrick Summers, I will give you back four musicians if you give me four singers. So it was supposed to be a 14-piece orchestra, right? Or 13. And I gave him back four players. So I was challenged in orchestrating that piece because it had to be quite delicate.
Yes.
But I wanted four great. I wanted soprano, alto, baritone, and tenor.
Absolutely.
And so it
and
really.
Aren't we glad you did that?
Yeah, it was fun. So that's Lenny. And he, Lenny really knew how to structure that piece because that is a hard piece. But he really knew the play. Yeah. And he knew how he was going to direct it. He knew how to work with Ricardo.
Yep.
I loved the way that show looked and felt. And I also felt like he was, Flick is a genius.
Yes.
But it was a hard piece for her. That is a big, big ass sing. And a lot of words to memorize.
Yes.
And by the way, she always, that woman, you put her in front of an audience.
Oh, man, she's formidable.
She is a star.
Yeah, my goodness.
And she was magnificent in that opera,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
I will have to say, too, that Lenny also gave himself very specific challenges in that piece because, we weren't going to have actors at first. And Lenny decided there needed to be those spoken scenes.
Yep.
And I thought, I bucked it sometimes. I was like, are you sure these shouldn't be set to music? And of course, it was supposed to be a one-woman opera. And by the time
It was Perrin Leach's comment. This is the biggest
one-woman opera I've ever seen.
Biggest cast I've ever seen in a monodrama.
Yes, exactly. So the thing is, you have to be a special director to also get those really legitimate performances out of real actors. It's like everything had to match, and I felt like Lenny made it seamless.
Yeah, yeah. It was a labor of love. It took a while to get there, but I really feel like the end product was just something else.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then finally, Royce. Royce is like me, only younger. I mean, I feel in a lot of ways, I definitely feel like when Royce and I got in a room, it was like, oh, we're made of the same sort of flesh and blood and bone.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel like he's exploding out of his skin in the same way I still am.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so, I have to say, Royce had come to me months before to say, I'll do anything to work with you. And I was like, who are you? I didn't even know who he was. And I was like, I'm not working with you. I'm working with Michael Corey and Mark Campbell and all the big ones. Royce hadn't done anything yet. And then Michael totally bagged. He canceled on me with 27. He couldn't do it. And he was an asshole. He waited till the last possible date. Like literally kept delaying it, and on the last day so that I had 12 minutes to write the opera, he canceled. And I didn't talk to him for 2 years. I don't care. You don't have to edit that out. But luckily, I remembered Royce. We were in this house, and I was so miserable. And Kevin said, you got to meditate. And I came to meditate, and I remembered Royce Vavrick. And I called him after I meditated, and I said, all right, listen to me. I have this commission to write an opera for Opera Theater St. Louis starring Stephanie Blythe. If you can read 15 books and write me a libretto in a month, you have the job. And Royce was like, yes, I'll meet with you Monday, because this was the Saturday. So Monday he comes over. I give him a pile of books or titles to read. And damn it, that we met on, let me just tell you, we met March 18th. By May 21st, I was writing that opera.
Oh my gosh.
And Royce was, he was just a delight. And the only thing that I had to, you know, he knew nothing about Gertrude Stein. Nothing. I mean, he had seen, you know, what's his name? Woody Allen's movie.
Sure, fine. That tells you nothing about
Midnight him. In Paris. Yeah, like, but, so he read everything. He read everything. And the amazing thing about Royce is he managed to pack into that 90-minute enchanting libretto everything seminal about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, everything I asked him, because I gave him a list of requirements. I was like, I want the painters to sing. My favorite line of Gertrude Stein's is, "Before the flowers of friendship faded, friendship faded." I told him we can't whitewash her. We have to deal with the speculation that something, happened to keep she and Alice safe during the war.
Oh, yes.
And he managed to put it all into that libretto. And by the way, the only problem with the first draft was he fell so much in love with Gertrude Stein's voice that the first libretto felt like Gertrude Stein had written it. And I just said, but you sort of have to take this home. And it has to be a little bit Royce Fabric voice. Like Gertrude Stein already wrote, you know, Mother of Us All and Four States of Three Acts. I need a Royce Fabric libretto. If you talk about the pieces I wrote with myself, with Michael Corey, with Lenny, with Royce and Mark Campbell, they really are all very different pieces.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and that has a lot to do with your collaborator, and the sort of the music is born out of what you think the words are saying. And each one of those people say something different.
Well, yeah. And I think that's the whole thing that just fascinates me about the collaborative process is, I mean, it's not that your voice goes away, but it shifts based on who's in the room with you. And I'm infinitely fascinated by how that works because, I mean, like you, we work in a collaborative art form where this is our whole life is dealing with other people and how they influence the way we operate. It's really a fascinating topic. What are the stories that the opera world should be telling now, or what do you feel like you personally want to be telling now from a storytelling point of view?
I really want to tell the stories that matter, but they're always going to be the stories that matter to me. You know, with Ellen West, that poem lived inside of me since 1996. Mm-hmm. And I knew I needed to tell that story. I knew from the moment I read it. And does someone else, is there another composer that wants to tell the story of a woman basically destroying herself because of an eating disorder and because of a problem with her own gender and living in her body? Not necessarily, but I identify with all those issues. And so the stories that I think are important to tell are the stories that I think are important to tell. And I can't say what someone else's stories, because nothing that is good is ever born out of, it's very rare that having a social conscience and doing what you think you should do as an artist is resonant. A lot of times that kind of work can feel like medicine. Mm-hmm. And I just want to tell stories that I'm passionate about telling. And I feel like because I'm passionate about telling them, and hopefully the other people I'm working with are passionate about telling them as well, they will be resonant and they will feel alive. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, working with Lynn Nottage now we're working on a second treatment, but I feel like Lynn isn't writing plays that she thinks she should be writing. She's hooked by, she happens to have a finger on the zeitgeist. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And she tells stories that impassion her, but she's also smart and connected. So there, I feel like Ellen West was a perfectly connected thing to tell right now, because most women all over the world. I mean, we're dealing with body image and gender and, you know, overwhelming expectations that we have for ourselves. Mm-hmm. But so I'm working with Lynn because I feel like she's telling important stories, but not because I think that it's going to get me further, just because her story, Intimate Apparel, is one magnificent play to have set to music.
Yeah.
And I love, she's working on a treatment now with her daughter, Ruby, who's a poet. So they're writing the thing together for
Very
me.
Very cool. Yeah.
So that's that's my story. Those are the stories I want to tell. It's interesting. The other night, nobody better steal this. But when I was watching Vive Le Savi, that Godard, My Life to Live.
Yes.
It's this, it's the story of a woman becoming a prostitute. It's really economical. And it's told in these short scenes. And I thought, I want to make an opera out of that. Because that is a story that I think is important and interesting. A woman who's faced with such poverty that the only thing she can do is sell her body.
Mm-hmm.
I still want to tell the stories. Those things matter to me.
Right. I think that's important. I think you're going to write better and you're going to write more passionately if it's something that matters to you. And hopefully, if it matters to you, it matters to other people too.
Yeah, and I haven't written anything that I didn't feel as mattered. And even with something like Coffer in Egypt, it was in working with Lenny. I'm not sure if when I first read that play, I thought this matters to me.
Yeah.
That was a piece that in wrapping myself around it and in working with Lenny and Flicka and everything, that piece came to matter to me.
Interesting.
Enormously. But when I first said yes, I said yes because of the people working on it.
Right.
And sometimes that will be your road in.
Right. Yes. That's often, from a directorial point of view, the road in that I'll say yes sometimes when I don't even know a piece, not knowing if I'm going to like it or feel something for it. But I'm so excited to be in a room with the players that I feel like we will find something important regardless of how I feel about the piece. And I think that's a major part of the collaborative process, is just being in a room of creatives that you feel akin to.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Frank Bedard, the Ellen West, he has two more poems I want to do. I right from the beginning, I wanted to create a trilogy. Mm. There's one called Herbert White, and it's really a one man's voice. And Herbert White is a serial murderer. And it's one of the most horrible texts I've ever read. But I want to write it because I feel like that someone got inside the mind of a serial murderer in the way Frank did. I think it's a very brave piece of writing, and I think it would be a really interesting exercise for an opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one he wrote is called The War of Václav Nijinsky. And it's a piece that goes straight into Nijinsky's madness.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
And I feel like that would be a dance opera. Like, I'd love to see a singer and a dancer in that piece. So those are some of my future projects. This thing with Lynn and more Frank Bedard Godard.
Yeah.
There must be more.
There will always be more.
And then I went and write with all my friends.
Yes.
And work with all my director friends. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. Ricky, thank you so much. This is such
Thank you, Katora.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you to Ricky for sharing so much of himself, and thank you also to Flicka for speaking so candidly about A Coffin in Egypt, as well as Michael Corey and Leonard Folia, who started off my podcast last year on such a great note. Thank you for listening. I'm Katora Stickan. If you'd like to hear these interviews in their entirety, as well as bonus materials and outtakes, you can become a patron of my podcast by going to patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. That's patreon.com/wordsfirstpodcast. All of my episodes from every season are also available at wordsfirst.buzzsprout.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Words First is recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. A special thanks to Matthew Doucet and Richard Stickan for their generous support,
Aurélie Doucet for a beautiful watercolored logo, Eileen Downey for the Mozart, and Randy Ravioli for the minimal barking. Until next time, take care of each other and keep telling stories.